from theunts.com. This is the Unts Podcast. Featuring artist interviews, unreleased tracks, and previews of the biggest events in electronic music. Available every week at theunts.com.
What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
Hello and welcome to the Unts Podcast. I'm your host, Anand Harsh. My guests today are Chris Gaspar and Manny Lukin of LA's electro powerhouse Cold Blank. The duo just premiered their single Louder Than Bombs this week on MTV Hive and are looking forward to the release of their new album The Agenda, which will be out in August. Gaspar and Lukin aren't newcomers by any stretch of imagination. They've been on the scene in LA for a while now, and we'll get the full story in just a minute. Let's first get to a quick word from today's sponsor, EDM Biz. In the midst of extensive growth and heightened interest surrounding electronic dance music, Insomniac has gathered an inspiring roster of industry pioneers and innovative business leaders to lead vital conversations at the inaugural EDM Biz conference. This is all going to be at the Cosmopolitan of Las Vegas, June 5th through the 7th, and the event's going to lead right into North America's largest electronic dance music festival, the 16th Annual Electric Daisy Carnival. Again, that's all online at edmbiz.com. If you'd like to sponsor an episode of the Unts Podcast, just drop me a line, A-N-A-N-D at theunts.com. Let's get to the interview. Chris, let's go ahead and start with you. The recent big news on your end is that you previewed a brand new single from your forthcoming album, The Agenda. And interestingly enough, Louder Than Bombs is a dubstep track, while the rest of The Agenda will pull more from your signature electro sound. What inspired the move to lead off with a dubstep track?
As artists, we're really into dubstep and drumstep, and like a lot of the recent stuff, you know, we've been hearing, and we've signed a bunch of tunes on Burn the Fire on our label, and some of our friends like Eric from Laser Tag, who's has his project Schoolboy, as a solo project, I believe he was the first dubstep artist we released, and we just, because we're like so into it, we've been playing some dubstep in our sets, something that we want to play around with, but not necessarily, it's not really our direction, because when we first decided to work together, we agreed we wanted to make electro house and have that be like the priority. So I believe that even though we do have we're into the whole grimy dubstep sound, it definitely has changed our sound a little bit, even in electro, but it's something that we just wanted to I guess try out, mess around with, and I guess just show if we were to make a dubstep track, this is what it would sound like. And honestly, it's not a direction that I feel like we're going in. It's just something we wanted to do for an album concept.
Sure. So you've got more of a been there, done that attitude towards it. This isn't going to be a common thing now for the Cold Blank sound.
Well, I think that the whole genre of dubstep has really kind of, it's still kind of developing in a sense, because I mean, there's still a bunch of room for subgenres, you know, and there's a bunch of new artists that even some that we've signed that have more of a melodic kind of flow, like Coyote Kisses, and there's our Adventure Club that are a little bit more mellow, but they still have the dub elements to them. And I think that a lot of it is very unexplored, and you know, there's either subgenres, but I feel like dubstep and even drum and bass and with modern technology and software, I feel like they can still go in a lot of different directions, and it's a very immature genre, I think, that can kind of go anywhere. And I feel like, you know, more than been there, done that, I think we just wanted to kind of take our vibe, the way we produce our kind of electro signature sound, and kind of go into it with, you know, using our style. And I mean, I'm not saying that we're never going to do a dubstep track ever again, but we want to focus on the fact that we're electro house producers, and that's still the direction that we are passionate about. You know, kind of playing around with different genres is fun, to be able to show that you're a versatile producer, and that, you know, you're not close-minded to, you know, a specific kind of genre. And you know, we wanted to show that we're also, we might not be full-time dubstep producers, but you know, that's something that we dig, and definitely I think it also kind of reflects that being the head of the label, that's something that we're into, we would definitely sign dubstep tracks. And I mean, we have put out like some really good ones, and we continue to get demos, and we definitely consider them. And it's, I think it's just a reflection of overall our whole feeling towards dubstep. We like it, and we wanted to make a track.
I want to get back to Burn the Fire in a second. But first, Manny, you told MTV Hive that Louder Than Bombs was not originally an instrumental track. Can you tell me about the sample you couldn't clear without getting in trouble with your legal team? Maybe dance around it a little bit?
Yeah, it wasn't actually a sample. We actually had a vocal featured on the track, but I don't think I could say who it is, but I don't know. But I don't want to go into details, but
sure.
We ended up hanging up with Columbia. We couldn't clear it. Basically we got the vocals and we had completed the tune, but we didn't get the heads up to go ahead and preview the track out until we had clearance from their management team of you know, the vocalists. And then once we were like finalizing all of the features on the album, they had just landed like a near $1 million deal with Columbia. So it just didn't go through. And so it just, we had to end up releasing it as an instrumental versus, you know, one of the, it should have been like the lead single with like vocals and stuff. But I mean, honestly, we were already really proud of it and really happy with it before. So it wasn't, I mean, it's a bummer, but it's not something that
it's not going to hurt the album.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It was just, honestly, I think it was the last feature we ended up getting. So, I mean, it was still very fresh. And I mean, I can't complain. MTV Hive covered the single, you know, without vocals. So I'm not complaining.
Louder Than Bombs, the new single from Cold Blank. Chris, when you were a kid, what were you listening to? Were you playing instruments?
Oh yeah, like before I got into electronic music, my transition was from like a rock band. So I was like the front man of like an electronic kind of like a dance rock kind of thing. It was, I guess, in a sense, something along the lines being influenced by like bands like The Faint and The Rapture, where like there was like an electronic sequence like present in their, like, you know, their tracks. And little by little, I think that as the scene changed, I naturally just kind of progressed into production after, I think it was after seeing Daft Punk at the Sports Arena. But I mean, even before that, I mean, it was all rock. My parents were really into like disco, so I think always hearing them play it around the house kind of always, I think the progression into house music was always something that just kind of lived in me, which is another reason why Burn the Fire is a very mixed genre label. Like, we have stuff that's, you know, dubstep, we have heavy electro tunes, we also have new disco stuff and indie dance releases, because I think we're just very open-minded and we have, you know, different tastes and styles, and we both bring that together into, you know, what we're into and what we want to put out.
Sure. Manny, did you have a similar sort of musical upbringing? Was it more rock and sort of the infiltrations of electronic music into rock that turned you on?
Yeah, mine was more like classic rock. I was in a hardcore band. I would play bass and keyboard. And I was more heavily influenced with like Nine Inch Nails, like with Trent Reznor
Pretty Deep Machine, the first, and that's what kind of got me into like electronic, like rock stuff like that. I just started going out to parties. And I just got into it like that.
That makes sense. That makes sense. And so, Chris, when did you guys meet and realize that you shared this passion for producing? And how did you go from, you know, probably talking about it like most kids do, to actually sitting down and turning things out as a team?
I think.
What, like 08?
Yeah, it was. I think we met in like maybe a year or two before we started working together. From what Manny was saying, the party scene where I grew up in Duarte and then moved to Arcadia, which is like really close to Pasadena in the San Gabriel Valley, which is like LA County, but it's like a suburb, mm-hmm. maybe like 20-minute drive from like downtown. And
sure.
here, the community here, it's not very, I guess like. When I was growing up, you know, dance music wasn't as popular. So whenever you would go to a house party or kickback, you know, you would never, ever hear anything like, you know, like the kind of like, you know, the kind of like the clubs of house stuff that you would hear in the 90s. Like none of that was present. Like you wouldn't hear Daft Punk. You wouldn't hear any of these like, you know, Ace of Base or any of that. That was like completely, it was gone. It didn't exist. It was all about hip hop. And I, you know, that's not what I was into. And so when I started exploring, you know, in LA where I could go to, you know, while I was underage to go party and listen to these tracks and this kind of vibe that I was going for, you would have to go into like LA or like, you know, other areas. So I would, you know, drive and go out to like anywhere from like Pico Rivera to, you know, South Central and those kinds of like neighborhoods. The parties were all about dance music, and it was all about, you know, like this whole movement where like, you know, people were starting to drop Justice and Mastercraft at these parties, and it developed mm-hmm. and it became a real scene where, you know, maybe Stevie Aoki's credited for like, you know, pushing this at Dimmock and like at the Banana, what was it called? Banana Split
yeah,
Sundays
Banana
or something. Yeah. So DJ AM and then might've had like the club scene and building that Ed Banger brand and kind of like bringing that cool vibe to the club scene and the festivals. But you know, there's still like the unsung heroes of the underground, like Manny, who has been DJing for like 10 years, who built that among like the house party scene and like the underground parties and warehouse parties and stuff that really like, it's not something that, you know, that is really ever mentioned or, you know, heard of, because in reality, the people who brought Justice over here were like Frankie Chan from My Heart Comics and Stevie Aoki from Dimmack. But, you know, the whole growth was like, it was everyone who was involved in this movement, everyone who wanted to spin these tracks at parties played a part in the growth of, you know, EDM. And I would go out to these parties and I would see Nanny DJing, and because I was getting into it, we became friends. He wanted to book my band for, you know, his like party that he was throwing, because, you know, back in the day it was about bands and DJs. It wasn't just like all DJs at a house party. They would have like one or two bands that could make people dance, and then it would be one DJ for the rest of the night. And now you have like five or six DJs at a house party, which is like ridiculous, because it's gotten to a point where I remember the last house party I played, there was like a better production than like some of the clubs I've played in like other parts of the world, you know. And like, and even in LA they have like these like huge like lots where like you go and there's more people than like clubs you play. Like there was literally like house parties with like 300-500 people. It was pretty crazy. And we met like that. And so one day we decided to just have like a session, share tracks, and then we realized that we were into like the same kind of music, the same producer, the same style of electro. And so I think the progression of us working together just like felt right, because we just happened to be playing like similar sets, and we were into the same producers at the time. Like I would say that one of them that really stood out to me was probably Wolfgang Gartner, because he only had like one track out on B-Port. And I told Manny, hey, you know, there's this track front to back by Wolfgang Gartner that's like incredible. I've been playing it all my sets. And then he shows me his iTunes on the top and it was right there. And I was like, oh, sick. And he's like, yeah, he's like my secret weapon. And I'm like, me too. And he was like, and at the time, you know, like he wasn't where he is now. Like it was like, you know, if you were into like electro, it meant you liked We Are Your Friends and like maybe like, yeah, Bloody Beetroot, Mastercraft. Not even Bloody Beetroot so much yet. It was more like Mastercraft. And LA Riots and Justice. And, you know, B-Port artists were like, B-Port wasn't I don't think it was as popular as it is now. And I think that, you know, that to me, it caught my attention that we were both into the same kind of music, the same producers that no one had heard of. And it just, it felt like it was just like a natural thing that we had to do. We had to work together because we had a similar taste. And I'm not saying we were the only ones who knew about Wolfgang Gartner, but, you know, it was something that stood out because out of everyone I knew, I think Manny was the only person who had. And I thought it was like, thought it was cool how we were both wanting to go in that direction of actually like producing something similar.
Ancient Psychic Tandem War Elephant from Cold Blank, right here on the Unts Podcast. So Manny, you had been in the scene for sounds like a decade, and there were these people who were putting on these shows, as you mentioned, Frankie Chan with iHeart Comics and Steve Aoki with Dimmock, and I imagine the early Check Your Ponytail sessions. Did you feel like there was room for you, or did you always feel like you were on the outside?
I would go there and party and like go network with those people, and I would go there every night. I would go out every night, and then on the weekends I would play at those parties, those warehouse parties and all the underground stuff, and bring out like, you know, the club music to the warehouses.
Long said it though. I mean, around the time when we started working together, he was booked for parties opening up for like Kill the Noise and, you know, Villains and Laser Tag, like at the Roxy and like at a ton of, you know, events like in Hollywood, you know, like when we started, like that's around the time when we started producing together. But before that, you know, the parties we would go to was, that was more of like the underground scene. And I mean, there was room for that because, I mean, Manny even threw his own party for like 2 years. And, you know, I became a partner with him like halfway into that. And I mean, we ended up having Wolfgang Gartner booked, and we, I think he broke his foot or something. And
he broke his leg like a few weeks before the gig.
But even though we did bring out like a bunch of producers like DJ Bam Bam, Will Bailey, Calevra, like a bunch of people that, you know, were at the time weren't playing in LA, and you know, we were throwing this party even before we really had a release on Beatport, just to kind of there was room for anyone who wanted to make make music, throw a party. And like now I feel like it's the opposite. Now everyone wants to be a DJ, and if you're not making music, then really you're not, the chances of you getting booked are like slim. And I mean, we know this because we hear it from like every promoter here, you know, like if a friend of ours wants to spin somewhere, you know, we already know that we can't just like say, hey, you know, like here's a mixtape for my friend. You have to have a release on a label with like, you know, with something to be playing at places like Avalon and Boyer and stuff. So
some sort of buzz, something on a Beatport chart, otherwise you're nothing.
Right. It's, I mean, even if you have tracks, like just if you have music, free bootlegs, like that works too. Like,
yeah.
But, you know, you have to have material that has your name on it, that is something that you made, because, I mean, even a mashup in this, you know, this age still works, but I would say that there, like, the room back then, there was definitely room for, like, anyone to be making music, because it was still, I mean, there were producers like Serkan that, you know, were young, and it was like, whoa, you know, this guy's like, what, like 19 or 18 or whatever, and it was like, it was amazing for anyone to be making music. But I mean, it was there, it's just that not a lot of people were taking advantage of it. And now you have, like, Porter, Robinson, Zed, Lucky Date, Dallas K, like a bunch of, like, you know, really young producers, and they keep coming every single day, like in the day.
Yeah, every day. We always get like a new person on every day.
I think it's funny, because in subjects where we get demos, we see like 14-year-old, 18-year-old, instead of like the name of their like their demo or their, like, you know, or their production name, they just put how old they are, because they want to get your attention with that. And it's smart and it's cool, but you know, there's so many now that I honestly, like, I feel bad sometimes turning down demos, because they're good demos and they're quality, but we just, you have to kind of set a standard when you have so many demos now, you know, and it's becoming kind of unreal when you hear, like, the quality. We're like, I think the three of the artists that we have on Burn the Fire are actually better producers than we are, but, you know, they're brand new and they haven't really had that many releases, but, you know, we're working with them a little bit more than like anyone else. And but I guess getting back to the point, I think there was still room at that time, and I think Manny and me were definitely taking advantage of that to kind of build our own brand and really progress into starting our own label. And we've gone into where we are from really just like kind of working and creating our own label and our own releases, and everything has been kind of self-made. And it's just, I feel like there's a lot more satisfaction behind that than to just signing. You know, we could have easily signed our first singles to like Dimmack or anyone, because they've always been like friends of ours, and I just felt like this has, it's, we've come a long way from it, and it's been awesome, you know, and I can't complain at all.
This is Cold Blank with Red Droid on the UNS podcast. So tell me about that decision then to create Burn the Fire. What was the necessity to have your own label, something that you could call your own?
I think originally it was just like a brand name. Burn the Fire was just like a brand, a company for our events. So it wasn't just like a flyer party on our, yeah, you know, on our flyer. We wanted to stand out a little bit and always build something like a brand or whatever. And so I guess it was an event company. And even though we just had like one party or two parties or whatever, and it was like a monthly thing, like it that's where it stemmed out from. And then, you know, I told Manny I wanted to like expand it into a label so we could release our own material. I guess we got a few, like, we got really lucky to get on Beatport, because, I mean, it's pretty difficult to just contact Beatport and say, hey, I want to start a label. I guess we had, like, a lot of support and a lot of, we had, like, these really big releases with big remixers at the time, like Aniki and TJR, Lee Mortimer, and but like a lot of established people were remixing us. So we had like, I guess we had like some leverage to say, hey, we want to start a label. We have all of these, you know, tracks ready and remixes ready to go. And And so it happened, we were able to get it, and building that brand was something that we just wanted to have, like, a, just a, like some sort of like catalog, you know, for our own material. But I feel like when Ed Banger kind of just like they stopped releasing, and there's like a bunch of like talented producers out there in the world who have that like French house style and like melodic vibe, new disco stuff, and that wasn't really, I felt like it just kind of disappeared when they stopped releasing it. So we wanted to keep that vibe going, so we would, you know, find these tunes and get electro house or dubstep remixers on the tunes to kind of bring that vibe into like, you know, other areas as well. And yeah, it just became a platform for not just, you know, our music, but we just started to pick up, you know, what we were into. We started signing our friends who, you know, who we wanted to kind of like debut out to the world. And now I feel like, you know, it is its own brand. Burn the Fire has expanded to becoming a label that a lot of electro producers want, you know, to start off with. Like, they'll, if they even get a response from us, they'll wait months to get a release, you know? And it's awesome because, you know, we never thought it would get to this point where we would have this many demos and this much success with it. Yeah. A label to, you know, put our own, just release a track on, you know, it wasn't like I didn't really see like a big picture for it. I think it was wishful thinking, you know, to think that you would be running a label that would get so much press and attention at the time, especially sure, coming from sure. like, you know, coming from the underground scene and stuff. Like, that wasn't really our plan, I don't think, at all. Well, at least it wasn't.
You don't
mine.
See yourself as suit.
Yeah, it definitely didn't see it getting to where it is. And I mean, like I said, it was if I did, it was wishful thinking because I honestly didn't buy it.
So then tell me what you can about the agenda, which drops in August.
Basically, we're going for it's a theme album. The agenda basically going off like our beliefs with the hidden agenda, the government, aliens, and it's just a kind of like a theme album. And we have a few collabs, Neon Stereo,
Electric Soul Sign, Blake Miller.
Electric Soul Sign, Blake Miller from Movie Units. Oh, that's another person that kind of brought me and Chris together too.
We're trying to clear one more featured artist, and it should be done within the next week. And if it's not, then, you know, then too bad. Like, just like the vocalists on Louder Than Bomb, you know, it's like if it happens, it does. If it doesn't, then it doesn't really affect the album.
Right. And then you guys are headed out to Wampapalooza in Michigan this weekend. Is this your first time out to the Midwest?
We played in Chicago.
Yeah.
But I don't think that might have been it, right?
Yeah, Chicago.
So yeah, I guess it's like our second gig out there, yeah.
Your Michigan debut, is there a sort of mindset that you put yourself in, or is there something special, some juice that you give your sets when you're making a big debut?
I think that it really depends on usually on the vibe of the event. Like, if it's a festival and we have like tons of people there, then, you know, we have like, I would say that we have a whole crate of tracks that we would only play for them, versus, you know, playing a club set where you have to be a little more, you know, careful and liberal about what you're playing there, because sometimes we play tracks that are too big for the club and then you just get stares. And I mean, it's something that we've, you know, been developing for years, and we have, you know, in 2011, I felt like all we were playing were like, you know, big festivals and raves, in 2010. And then in 2011, we just did like, we toured the world playing clubs. And it was, you know, it's a little different when you've kind of been playing, you know, these raves and festivals for, you know, tons of people. And then you just, all of a sudden you're playing for like less than 1,000 in a room. And, you know, you have to be more selective about what you're playing. But I think this event, because it's called Wampapalooza, it just sounds like really wobble. It seems like they would love the like wobbly and fidgety stuff. So I think that we definitely have a ton of secret weapons to be dropping there.
Perfect. I'm sure they're excited about it. Wampapalooza this weekend, and then of course the agenda drops in August. Chris Gaspar, Manny Lukin of Cold Blank, thanks so much for being on the UNS podcast.
For sure.
Yeah, no pleasure.
That's going to do it for this week's episode. Special thanks go to John, as well as Sam and Jason with Technique Management, and of course my guests, Chris Gaspar and Manny Lukin. Stay up to date with Cold Blank's touring schedule by hitting up theunst.com/coldblank. Today's show is brought to you by EDM Biz. Go to edmbiz.com to register for this dance music industry conference, and you can get discounted tickets to EDC Vegas. Please visit theunts.com for news, artist profiles, and tour dates from across the electronic music spectrum. And go ahead and subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. Write us a review. Tell us what you think of the show. If you have any questions, comments, or complaints about the program, you'd like to be a guest on the Unts podcast, or you'd like to sponsor an episode, contact me at anand@theunts.com. That's A-N-A-N-D @theunts.com. Join the conversation at the Unts podcast on Twitter. We'll catch you next week.